to have my own clock. You'll yell at me when I'm done.
Okay, they're gonna, what are they gonna do to honor rebuttal? They will, but they're not gonna split it. Okay. Okay, here's, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, first of all. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today. With me are Judges Larkin and Riley. Among other things, today is Constitution Day, and it's an honor to sit here and at least recognize for a moment the gravity of what was done in 1787 on this day. My understanding is that counsel for appellants want to split 10 minutes and five. Who's going to take 10?
Your Honor, Alan Silver, I'm the counsel for North Star and Lundell McMillan, and I was going to take the first five.
And you're going to take the first five?
First five.
Okay.
And then Mr. Rosenberg, who is counsel for CAK, and Mr. Koppelman will take 10, and we would like to reserve five for rebuttal.
Okay. And what are you going to do with your rebuttal? Split it, or are you going to decide who rebuts?
We're going to decide at the time, depending on the focus of the argument.
Fair enough. And you're not splitting over here?
No, Your Honor. Peter Gleeko with my colleague, Bradley Prawant, who's also with my office.
Okay. And my own preference when I preside is to not be resetting the clock all the time. So we'll start with 15, and it'll be up to you to and your colleague to decide when to stop at 5. And when you stop, we'll pause, and then counsel could continue. But
that's fine, Your Honor.
Out of town, is it not polite to throw something at Mr. Silver?
Well, under the circumstances, it being Constitution Day and all, I'll say no. We won't do that.
Our normal local practice is you tackle me. And
the reason I do that is sometimes when I've done it the other way, counsel on the first part of the argument adds an extra 2 or 3 minutes on, and then counsel on the second part adds another. And pretty soon we're here a lot longer than we intended to be.
I'll try to resist the impulse to do that to Mr. Rosenberg.
All right. You may proceed, Mr. Silver.
And Your Honor, the way we've set this forth is I'm going to primarily address the injunction issue, the fact that the court's order of March 11th, 2019 was in fact an affirmative temporary injunction that was issued without any analysis of the Dahlberg factors and therefore should be reversed. Mr. Rosenberg will be primarily addressing the contract issues and the application of the statute.
Okay.
So turning to the injunction issue, and of course we'll be available to answer any questions the court has on any topic at any time. On March 11th, the court issued an order that directed the two appellants collectively to pay millions of dollars to the plaintiff during the pendency of this litigation, and it did so without analysis of any of the traditional Dahlberg injunction factors. And it's black letter law not contested in the respondent's brief that the issuance of an injunction without analysis of the Dahlberg factors is reversible error. There's two reasons why we believe that what the court issued was an injunction. First of all, the order had all of the characteristics of a temporary injunction. And secondly, and I think even more importantly, this is not a case of first impression. This court already addressed that issue. At the time we appealed the case, we were asked to brief the question of whether or not the court had jurisdiction. We argued that because this was a temporary injunction, that the court had subject matter jurisdiction to consider this appeal, and the court agreed with us. The court issued an order on May 7th, 2019, stating that this was a temporary injunction. The court expressly stated that the order, quote, has the characteristics of a temporary mandatory injunction, unquote, and then an order that directs return of property for the purpose of preserving the status quo ante pending determination of the main action is appealable as a temporary mandatory injunction, unquote. What's really amazing about the respondent's argument in response to that is that they don't, in their brief, even mention this court's order. I mean, that's a controlling order that we believe is the law of the case, and it's not even mentioned in the respondent's brief. They argue, and they don't really even argue specifically that this wasn't an injunction. Their heading of their brief is that the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, despite the fact that this court already ruled that it does have subject matter jurisdiction. And they make that argument without even referring to the prior order. So we have a controlling decision of a special term panel of this circuit that is directly being attacked by the respondent without any reference to the order. It's really an amazing argument. There are a number of cases that we cited in our brief and Mr. Koppelman's counsel cited in their brief that state that when a panel of this court issues an opinion, that is the law of the case and may not be attacked subsequently in the proceedings. And the cases actually say specifically that includes a special term panel. There's one case that was cited in Mr. Koppelman's case, the Ahmed case, which is factually not similar. It's a criminal case. But in terms of the rule of law, it's right on point, which is that a court in a special term panel decided that the court had subject matter jurisdiction. It was then attacked during the briefing on the issue in chief or in the case, and the court said that the panel was bound by the special term consideration or the special term determination. The order also has the characteristics, as this court said in its May 7th order, the order has the characteristics of a temporary mandatory injunction. The courts under Minnesota law have defined it says that a judicial process requiring the person to whom it is directed to do or refrain from doing an act, a particular thing, is an injunction. And that was the Bellows case that made that ruling. And an injunction may be either affirmative or negative. And frankly, in this case, all we really need to do is look at the language of the trial court itself. When the court issued its March 11th order, the probate court said that what it was doing was trying to preserve the status quo pending the outcome of the litigation. It was directing a payment, not even into court, but a payment to the estate during the pendency of the litigation. It's hard to imagine anything that is more typical of a temporary injunction. This is kind of a classic example of an injunction where the defendant is ordered to pay money into court. And I use the word defendant somewhat loosely because, as Mr. Rosenberg will certainly point out, there was never a summons and complaint in this case, so we don't even really have a plaintiff and a defendant. All this was done by motion. All right. So, Your Honor, you are very subtly signaling to me that my 5 minutes is up, so
I'm just letting you know.
I will defer to Mr. Rosenberg, but the relief we are requesting is that the court reverse the temporary injunction, but even more importantly, that the court do that with instructions with respect to how the court should approach this, and that's, I think, what Mr. Rosenberg will address.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, John Rosenberg, and the court granted me leave to appear. I never take that for granted. I take it as a privilege, and I appreciate it very much. As Mr. Silver said, the injunction issue has really been addressed, and because of the lower court's admitted failure to address any of the Dahlberg factors, that would require, as a matter of law, a remand on its own. But I'm here on a broader and more fundamental issue, and that's whether the entire proceeding under the Minnesota Statute 524.3-721 was the appropriate mechanism to address these issues.
That's my question for you. I'm looking at your reply brief, and you say at the bottom of page 3, appellants seek the remand of this matter to the probate court so that the court may address the estate's admittedly contract-based claim in the context of a proper plenary action with all of the attendant procedural and due process protections. Tell me what you mean by that.
This statute, which says that if the fees of a representative, it would include an attorney of the estate, are excessive, they have to be reasonable, that the probate court has the right to revisit that issue. That is not the issue in this appeal. This claim does not in any way concern, in any way, whether the appellant's fee commission was reasonable. The fee was established by a written contract, and it is a fixed fee. It is not discretionary. It's not based on an hourly rate. It's a fixed fee for services performed. It is not, it is a contract issue. If the advisor agreement stated, if the advisors have been paid the commissions, but the underlying transaction on which the commission was based is rescinded, they have to give the commission back. If it said that, Mr. Gleeckel wouldn't be arguing, oh, the fees aren't reasonable. He'd be saying they breached the contract. They won't give us the fee back. And paragraph 14, whatever, says give the fee back. Conversely, if the agreement stated that once the commission is paid, even if the underlying transaction is terminated or rescinded, that the advisors don't have to give the fee back, we wouldn't be arguing whether it's reasonable. We'd be arguing what does the contract state. If I could give two examples, if the court would indulge me, that I think clarify the distinction. Let's say the personal representative of an estate hires an attorney, very common thing, at $250 an hour, and they go to the probate court and get the engagement letter approved. So there is a contract. It's been approved for $250 an hour. The representative says to the lawyer, I want you to do one thing, and one thing only, write a one-page letter that tells the heirs that we're going to meet in my office next week. The lawyer does that, submits a bill for 100 hours of work for $20,000. Now, is there a contract? Yes, but the contract established only the hourly rate. The probate court in that instance would certainly have the right to say those fees aren't reasonable, 100 hours to write a two-paragraph letter. Example one. Example two, when I was in high school, I painted houses. So I'm going to retire from being a lawyer and go back to painting houses. Personal representative, the estate owns a house. They enter into a contract to sell the house. The buyer says, I love the house, but it needs to be painted, and I want the estate to take care of that. The estate says, okay. They enter into a contract with me to paint the house for $5,000. We go to the probate court. Probate court says, I've looked at different prices for painters, and that's a reasonable price. It's a reasonable price, $5,000. I paint the house. I am then paid. Then a third party surfaces and says to the estate, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. You can't sell that house to the buyer. I own the house. The estate says, I don't want litigation over this. Fine, we'll cancel the sale. And then the personal representative says to me, the house painter, give me the money back. There's no issue in that case as to whether my fee was reasonable. $5,000 to paint the house, the probate court said was reasonable. The question is, under my agreement, do I have to give it back? And while Mr. Gleeckel in his brief argues that this is not a contractual matter, when I was preparing yesterday, I isolated 10 separate times. I'll give just certain examples. He says at page 17, the estate did not contract with the advisors for precarious arrangements, and he goes on to describe what they did. That's a contract issue. Page 20, quote, it is peculiar the advisors can fail to perform under the advisor agreement. That's a quote. Fail to perform under the advisor agreement. That's another way of saying they breached the contract. Page 22. The commissions were paid to the advisors for performance later shown to be defective. That's a breach of contract. Page 22. Again, the merits are whether the advisors earned their commissions. Page 29. This is Mr. Gleeckel. To find otherwise is to allow the advisors to underperform, i.e. not uphold their end of the advisor agreement and still retain their commissions. Page 32, very important. The unambiguous intent of the advisor agreement. The unambiguous, that's a contractual question. If it's unambiguous, the court will rule. If it's ambiguous, a jury must rule. Page 33, without the underlying transaction, the advisor agreement is clear. The advisors have no basis on which to claim entitlement to the $33.1 million commission. Two more. Page 34. The advisor agreement allows for retaining a commission, and he goes through when it does. The only reasonable inference from the contractual list of scenarios is that the commission here can't be retained. Page 36, the advisor agreement is determinative of the issue. Page 37, the unambiguous intent of the advisor. But this is a contract action. If Mr. Glico believes that the appellants are required to repay those commissions, even though, Your Honor, paragraph 6 of the advisor agreement, Your Honors, paragraph 6 states the commissions are earned. They are earned when the monies for the underlying transaction are paid to the estate. They are earned. Paragraph 6 continues by saying the commission cannot be revoked. Our position is we'll win on summary judgment. Well, maybe we don't. Maybe there is an issue of contractual intent. Maybe there isn't. But you can't circumvent, it's Constitution Day, I didn't know that, the Minnesota's Constitution guarantee of a jury trial and the Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedures, a complaint, an answer. We have third-party claims here. Why did UMG want rescission? What did Warner Brothers say to them? Mr. Gleickel's brief is replete with disputed facts about what happened. That needs to be resolved with a complaint and answer. Third-party practice, counterclaims, discovery, summary judgment, jury trial, and the like. The statute has no application, and if it does, Mr. Gleickel says that the court under the statute has the power to order the appellants to return the commissions without an evidentiary hearing or any hearing. Let's think about the consequences. This is actually, I think, a significant issue of statutory construction. If that's correct, a party could enter into an agreement with the estate for a fixed contractual compensation, X dollars or X percent, fully perform. Then the estate, after they've accepted the performance under this argument, could come in to the probate court and said, under the statute, it overrides the Constitution, it overrides the rules of service. Under the statute, it's equitable. You can revisit this. That raises its own troubling constitutional questions, whether a court can essentially rewrite the private undertaking of the parties. Mr. Gleickel's response is to say, well, you know, the statute says it's for a quick and efficient resolution. Well, that may be, but that doesn't mean you can ignore rules, law, and the Constitution because you'd prefer quick and efficient.
Actually, I have a question about that. It looks to me from the district court's order that the district court doesn't expect this to be the last order. Instead, it's to be held in a segregated account until something happens. I'm not entirely sure what the something is, some later litigation.
Until something happens. By the way, there already is a plenary action on the Jobu component of this.
Right.
Why isn't there a plenary action on the UMG component of this? All we're asking, don't want this court to make a decision. All we're asking is because of the failure to address Dahlberg, the injunction fails, and as it gets sent back, I sincerely believe this is an important issue of statutory and procedural rules and constitutional magnitude as to whether breach of contract claims with disputed facts can be adjudicated through a summary proceeding without pleadings, discovery, and a jury trial. I see that even without my glasses, I see the zeros, and I will reserve the right, depending where it goes for rebuttal, with thanks.
Mr. Rosenberg? Not so fast. We have one question, and see, we hold you to the time, but not ourselves.
I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Under your argument, might it be appropriate at the front end of this transaction, while the parties are determining what the terms of the contract will be, for a district court to take a look at it and say yes or no, those are reasonable terms given what's going to come out of the estate, but that once those terms are set in an agreement, they're binding, and then we go to contract law to figure out whether there's been a breach of contract.
And
so the statute has some application, but it's more of a front-end application than fixing it when it goes wrong.
I wish I'd thought of that argument myself. That's exactly right. The court did review this in a contested proceeding with the issue of reasonableness of the fee was the central issue. In the first place, and said this fee is reasonable.
So now we have a situation where we have the agreement, and there's an allegation, what, either that the fee is not reasonable because there wasn't performance, which sounds like a contract violation.
Precisely,
okay,
correct.
I got it. Thank you.
I may now depart.
You may, and thank we you. Won't deduct that time off your file.
I'm not going to leave too far away, though.
It's up to you.
Your Honors, Counsel, I would like to address the two issues that...
And it's Mr. Glico for the Special
yes,
Administrator.
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor. I'm here yep. with my colleague, Mr. Perron, as well. I would like to address, with the Court's indulgence, the two issues that have been addressed by Counsel. One, that Judge Ide's March 11, 2019 escrow order is not effectively a temporary restraining order.
Then my question with regard to that is... We have an order of the special term of this court saying it is. Isn't that the law of the case?
Your Honor, the way I read that is that you have an order saying that this court has jurisdiction to hear the appeal. I don't believe that based on the full record there's been a necessary judicial finding that the order is in fact a temporary restraining order. And the second issue I'd like to address is contrary to what counsel argued that the probate court did properly exercise its discretion under 524.3-721 and provisionally requiring that the fees be placed in escrow. Stated otherwise, it's not a breach of contract case, nor should it be one. And the argument on the breach of contract, I submit, ignores the statutory scheme that provides the foundation for the jurisdiction and the manner in which the probate court is to exercise that discretion.
What is the argument as to why excessive compensation was paid?
The argument as to why excessive compensation is paid is because there was no value delivered to the estate on which a 10% structure was employed. And that's the distinction I think that needs to be made. There was the fee structure was approved by the court. The advisor agreement also provides in the fourth whereas clause, which is incorporated in the agreement, that in the third whereas clause, that the duties and the powers of the special administrator and its agent are subject to governed by orders issued by the Carver County Court. I think that calling this a breach of contract case ignores that this is in the context of a probate. And we have to take a look at the probate code and what the probate code tells us as to the way the probate court is to conduct its business. Now, first of all, In re Estate of Congdon does stand for the proposition that the allowance of fees is a matter of discretion for the district court. But let me walk through the building blocks, the foundation of how the probate court operates in its jurisdiction. Under 524.1-102A, it states that the probate code is to be liberally construed to promote its purpose and its policies. 524.102B3 states that a policy of the probate code is to promote the speedy and efficient system of liquidating the estate of the decedent and making distributions to successors. Then 524.1-302A states the probate court has jurisdiction over all subject matter relating to the estates of decedents. 524.3-105 indicates that the jurisdiction is exclusive. And 524.1-302B states that the probate court, the district court, has full power to make orders, judgments, and decrees and take all other actions necessary and proper to administer justice in matters which come before it.
And that raises my primary question, which is there is a separate lawsuit involving JOBU. So presumably procedural due process and all of the rights attendant with that are going to be afforded and looked at in that lawsuit. With regard to the UMG, how are the advisors' due process, procedural due process rights going to be protected?
Well, first of all, let me address the JOBU case. And I don't believe, and I could be wrong, if the court has the various pleadings in the JOBU case as part of the appendix. The JOBU case was started by JOBU against the advisors for fraud. Mm-hmm. We, the estate, started an action against JOBU alleging a breach of a contract on a $7 million guarantee. We pled in the alternative that because if JoBu prevails on its frauding the inducement claim, then JoBu will argue that it is entitled to rescind that agreement. It never existed with the estate. And we then pled in the alternative that if JoBu prevails, then it's our theory that the advisors, in performing their fiduciary duties to the estate, violated those fiduciary duties by committing fraud on JoBu, and that the estate then was damaged by losing what we would have to prove would have been an alternative income stream from the tribute. The advisors' fees, the commissions that we contend were never earned, are not a part of that case. Now, with respect to what the court has inquired about due process and that my colleague has raised, Judge Eide, in his wisdom, entered a provisional order. He ordered that the money be escrowed. And if I have time, I may not. That's why I want to address why this is not a TRO under Howard and Howard, the Minnesota Supreme Court's reliance on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Carson. Okay? I lost my train of thought.
Judge Larkin has a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Probably caused that. I just wanted to ask a question before you move on
of
to
course.
The TRO.
I wasn't going to move on to the TRO, but please.
You said the fees were never earned. That, to me, sounds like fees were never earned because they didn't comply with the agreement, which sounds in contract. And I hear what you're saying about the broad jurisdiction of the probate court, but it seems to me there are two ways to look at that. One is the probate court can do everything, but we do it in the same fashion that we would normally do it. If it's a contract claim, we have a complaint. It just all gets assigned to the probate judge who's presiding over the estate. Are you proposing something else in which the probate court has broad jurisdiction to preside over any dispute related to the estate, and in which case all those disputes are kind of resolved fast and loose under the probate code without the formalities that would attend to the case if we weren't dealing with an estate?
I'm not arguing to that degree, Your Honor. Because
if, but what happens what, here what, to determine whether or not the fees were never earned? I mean, in your view, what how do we determine that in the probate court? What's going to happen?
How we determine it as a practical matter is what Judge Eide has told us how we're going to determine it. When he entered his provisional order, his escrow order, Judge Eide said, we're going to come back, we're going to talk about what discovery the advisors think they need, and then we're going to have an evidentiary hearing. So really the only thing we're arguing about is I want a jury trial. But I come back to what the legislature has said under 524.1302B, that the probate court has full power to make orders, judgments, and decrees, and take all other actions necessary and proper to administer justice in matters which come before it. Now, if Judge Eide had said, listen, I'm just going to decide this on the papers, enter a judgment, we're up here. And that's going to dovetail
my TRO. So the difference is the jury trial.
That's what I see, because Judge Eide said, we're going to let you do discovery, we're going to have an evidentiary hearing. If Judge Eide had said, nope, I'm deciding it on the papers, I believe I have the power and the jurisdiction, the appellants could have come before this court arguing Judge Eide abused his discretion. He didn't give me a hearing. He didn't allow me to do discovery. They would have had that right to appeal that. But the statute gives the probate court this jurisdiction and this power. And one of the tools, as I said, is 524.3721. And the last sentence says, any person who has received excessive compensation from a state for services rendered may be ordered to make appropriate refunds. It's not a breach of contract case. It's a probate matter.
Well, but it seems like it's a breach of contract case in the context of a probate proceeding, because you have to determine whether or not there's been receipt of excessive compensation. And how do you, I mean, you need a legal theory to make that determination.
Well, you do, and you do if you take, for example, Mr. Rosenberg's first hypothetical. Lawyer under contract to the estate says, I'm going to, under contract, devote 1 hour of time at $250 an hour to write this demand letter, puts in how many hours were hypothesized by Mr. Rosenberg for his fee. I think he said it was $100,000. you then come into court and say, no, the contract said you got $250 an hour to write a letter. That's what the contract said. But you went beyond the contract, so you're not entitled. The fee is excessive because you're in violation of the contract by which you contractually bound yourself to 1 hour or so to write a letter. It's the same argument. Because there was a contract, it's not that simple.
I think you're talking about the wrong hypothetical. This is more like the house painter case, isn't it?
No, because here in the house painter case, the painter painted the house. Here, there was not an agreement, either with respect to UMG or Jobu, that delivered any financial or pecuniary value to the estate.
Was that required in the contract? The advisor agreement?
Yeah. Our position is...
Where's that?
Where is it?
Yeah. Serious.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. It's the commission's 6A sets out the structure.
What page of the advisor agreement are
you on? It would be page 3, Your Honor.
Okay.
Okay. 6A talks about the fee structure is 10% on a defined term, gross monies. Gross monies is then defined under 6C, which has a laundry list of specific examples, income payments, compensation, or, quote, anything other in value to the estate. It's our position that because of the rescission and the termination, there was no value, there was no pecuniary benefit to the estate from either of these two transactions. Therefore, the 10% that went to these advisors from the payors at the time the initial money was sent under letters of direction and on which they're still sitting is excessive because there was no pecuniary value to
the
estate.
So the last paragraph of Judge Ide's memo attached to the order says talks about some of his concerns, and he says the court will not, however, make a final determination as to the estate's entitlement to a refund of the advisor fees without a full record and consideration of the provisions of the advisor agreement, which, as Judge Larkin says, sounds like contract interpretation. Or,
Your Honor, it will require Judge Ide to refer to the contract, but with all due respect to counsel, it's too simplistic to say it's a breach of contract, therefore you need to start another action, therefore we're entitled to third-party practice, therefore we're entitled to discovery, therefore we're entitled to a jury, therefore we're entitled to lay this thing for another year to 2 years.
Well, aren't those all things that should be argued and decided in the first instance in the district court? I mean, who knows what the district court does if and when this goes back, and then if someone's unhappy with what the district court has done in terms of procedure, we'll have that appeal.
With Judge Ide?
Right.
Yes, I agree, okay. And that's the problem I have, coming full circle, and I'm running real short here, with respect to a finding that this is effectively a TRO. And let me briefly address that. In the Howard case, the court did recognize that an order doesn't have to be designated a restraining order to be a restraining order for purposes of appellate purposes. But it laid out some factors. And it says, we're not going to outline all the boundaries of these factors, but we're going to give you some factors. We're going to give you some factors to look at to make a decision whether or not this is a restraining order, effectively a restraining order. And that's our argument, and effectively it isn't. The first one, did we seek an injunction, or did the district court order address a request for injunction? That's a no. It's obvious. The more difficult one is, and this is where it takes some analysis, is in the second factor, the Howard court says, did the lower court apply the equitable factors to be evaluated on a request for an injunctive relief, i.e. the Dahlberg case? Here the court didn't do it, and we don't dispute that. But here's the key, I submit. In Howard, the Minnesota Supreme Court, acknowledging that the district court did not consider the balance of harms to the parties, one of the factors in Dahlberg, cited the U.S. Supreme Court case in Carson against American Brands, Inc. And there, the U.S. Supreme Court found there was no jurisdiction to an interlocutory appeal unless a litigant can show that an interlocutory order has the practical effect of an injunction that typically has serious and perhaps irreparable consequences and that can be effectively challenged only by immediate appeal. That's not what we have here. They haven't even argued that this has serious and perhaps irreparable consequences. I want to race through this. what happens is we go back to Judge Idy, and what this also implicates is the longstanding policy against piecemeal appeals. We go back to Judge Idy. If Judge Idy denies the motion, the money is released from escrow, goes back to the advisors. Judge Idy, after determining what is a fair procedure in the first instance, and that's what he's left the door open by his provisional order, decides the estate's entitled to a refund of that money. We now have a final order. I suspect we're back in front of this court on the same issues that we're here today, with the exception of the issue of whether or not this is a restraining order, which necessarily then implicates the fact that this is piecemeal appellate practice. Same issues. My time is up.
May I?
You may.
Setting aside whether or not this is a restraining order, what's the authority for Judge Idy to have ordered the money deposited in escrow?
The authority for Judge Idy would be the statute, and I apologize, I don't have them committed to memory, that 524.1-302B says that the probate court has full power to make orders, judgment, and decrees, and take all other actions necessary and proper to administer justice in the matters which come before it. Thank you.
How do appellants wish to split, if you wish to split your rebuttal time?
Mr. Silver, and by the way, it's his birthday, I'm told, today, has graciously allowed me to conclude.
Happy birthday.
Not quite as important as Constitution Day.
It's close. A question was asked about what it is that the advisors did, is it constitutes a failure to perform. Mr. Gleickel partially quoted, very important, and he does it in his brief, from the advisor agreement. He said it requires that, and he quoted, a thing of value be given. That is not what the contract says. Paragraph 6C on page 3 of the advisor agreement defines gross monies to mean all forms of income, payments, compensation, emoluments, and or any other thing of value given to the estate in lieu of compensation. The thing of value is you get paid money, you get this, that, but if you get something else in lieu that's of value, in lieu of compensation, this agreement does not require some general sense that something of value be provided. It requires that there be compensation. And Mr. Gleickel's argument and brief are remarkably silent on paragraph 6, my memory tells me, D2, 62 of the advisor agreement, which I believe is on page 4, says, let me find it so I don't misquote it, advisors shall be deemed to have earned advisors' commission simultaneously with the payment to administrator or administrator's affiliates of gross monies. So when UMG paid the commission, my client, CAK, and North Star, Mr. Silver's client, earned the commission. 6A says the commission can't be revoked. But these are all issues to be taken up in a breach of contract or a declaratory judgment action as to what the contract means, what the parties' respective rights and obligations are. Now, Mr. Silver ably cited all kinds of provisions of the probate code. But respectfully, and Your Honor pointed out one, the fact that the probate court has jurisdiction over estate matters, hardly a remarkable proposition, has nothing to do with what procedure, what type of action has to apply. The fact that the probate code encourages a efficient and speedy, those are the words, adjudication of estates, doesn't mean that constitutionally and procedurally required mechanisms can be overlooked. Mr. Gleickel also said the only issue is the jury trial. That's not true. Judge Edie's order says, all right, I'm going to have an evidentiary hearing to determine what, if any, compensation. That's what he says at the end of the first part of his order. It's right at the bottom, my memory. It says, what, if any, compensation? Respectfully to the probate court, he doesn't have the right to determine what, if any, compensation is owed. The contract determines what, if any, compensation is owed. And if Mr. Gleickel believes my client, using his words, underperformed, failed to perform, didn't perform, bring a breach of contract action. If he believes that the contract by its terms or by inference, as he argues, by intent, as he argues, if he believes that it requires my clients to give back the money, then bring a declaratory judgment action, which is the flip side of a breach of contract action, still subject to a jury trial. Mr. Glico said the only thing we're complaining about is the jury trial. That's not true. We want traversable allegations that we can either move to dismiss or admit or deny. The ability to file a cross-claim. Why did Warner Brothers, the UMG agreement had provisions that recognized Warner Brothers might assert rights and there were protections. Why did UMG require rescission? Why did the estate agree to rescind when the contract it entered into already protected it? Was consideration paid? I'm not accusing anything nefarious. I don't know. Was there tortious interference? I don't know. With this collusion, and I've been in the music business for the better part of 50 years, both as a performer and as a lawyer, was there collusion between Warner Brothers and UMG? I'm not accusing them of that. I'd sure like the chance to find out. Why did the estate not only pay back the $28 million that it received, but it paid back the $3.1 million that Universal had paid to the advisors? These are fact-bound issues. Mr. Gleickel's brief says that when issues are fact-bound, there has to be a jury trial, except for like attorney's fees. This is not about the lodestar, the amount of time spent, the result obtained. This isn't, and by the way, Mr. Gleickel misunderstood, I'll take responsibility, my example. My example was not a contract that said that the lawyer get paid for 1 hour to write a letter. It was a contract that said your hourly rate is $250, was silent as to what the assignment was going to be, and then the lawyer took 100 hours. That's what the statute is for. I believe it was Your Honor who said this is more like the house painting analogy. We painted the house. We earned the commission when the underlying monies were paid. The estate chose voluntarily to rescind the transaction. We didn't ask it to. And we're entitled to no more, no less than we just want a complaint and an answer and discovery. I hope I have not overstayed my welcome.
Nope, it was perfect. That's the
first time in my career I've been perfect, I assure Your Honor. Thank you. Again, it's a privilege.
The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. Happy birthday, and the case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.